Welcome to the Zulu Time podcast, a straight talking conversation between two watch enthusiasts about the world of military watches. I hope you enjoy.
Hello and welcome to episode 88 of the Zulu Time podcast with your host Dan from Timely Underscore Moments. So happy new year, everyone, because obviously you're listening to this now in January. I'm not recording it in January. I've done some time travel and I'm recording it in November because I'm really good and really good at admin in terms of the podcast. So I hope you guys all had a good Christmas and obviously have hit the new year with a positive mental attitude and you had a great break effectively. So that's what I hope for you. If you didn't have a great break or you didn't have a break because you're deployed, obviously I hope you look forward to a break that will come in due course. However, I've started the year strong, I like to think, with an interview for this week's episode or this episode. Before we move on to my interviewee, very quickly, I also hope that you enjoyed the last episode of the year in 2023 with Elliot Brown, because it took me the best part of 4 months to nail down a date because I've been busy. Also, I had been busy. They were also busy with shows and various releases, but I'm really glad that I managed to close out 2023 with an Elliot Brown interview, which is really cool. Without further ado, I'm going to bring Larry, who is over at Cywar Wrist Check, onto the pod. So Larry, happy new year, bro. Welcome to the pod. I hope you had a good Christmas break.
Hey, Dan, how's it going? Happy new year. Hopefully you had a fantastic time with family and friends. It was good. It was very relaxing. We stayed home and enjoyed time with the family. And yeah, glad to be here.
Good. I'm glad that you had some family time. And like I said, I'm really glad that you've managed to give up some time for me, obviously, to talk watches and all the other stuff that the Zulu Time podcast audience enjoy. Before we get into you, your career, a little bit about your career and obviously your page, you're aware that the podcast has two traditions. The first tradition is a wrist check. And obviously the second tradition is the closing note. As we're at the beginning of the episode, what watch do you have on your wrist today?
All right. So today I'm wearing my Grand Seiko SBGX 261G. There's no nickname. It's not, there's no fun nickname like the Moonwatch or anything. So mm-hmm. I call it the Plain Jane. Nice. Actually, that was from Adrian Barker. You mentioned that in one of his YouTube videos. But I purchased this back in October as kind of like my go anywhere, do anything fancy watch. Mm-hmm. It's got a 9F quartz movement, black dial. Everything is polished to their Zeratsu, or I think I've read it as black polish standard or mm-hmm. satin finish. So I like how Grand Seiko kind of takes the elements of a basic 38 millimeter watch and just makes it extraordinary. So yes, it is boring. Like if you can see right here, it's just plain black watch. You've seen it everywhere. Mm-hmm. But the more you look into it, between the Delphine hands and the way that everything is just polished to where there's no distortion, like that mirror-like finish, it really shines mm-hmm. regardless of any lighting situation. What about you? What do you have on today?
Well, before we move on to what I've got on, I mean, I know you're saying that it's a plain Jane watch, but like you said, the attention to detail with that black polishing, the Zeratsu polishing, and just the case finish and the finish on the handset, I think if you know what you're looking at, I think Grand Seiko and obviously a quartz Grand Seiko is definitely a watch person's watch. That's what I'd say. but it looks really good. It does look really good. And I personally have never had any like ownership experience with a Grand Seiko, and you never know. Who knows what is obviously in the future. But I think what they provide in terms of that attention to detail and that subtle finishing is just fantastic. Especially in the photos that I see of it on obviously on your page, and I've seen of it in other pages. It's really good. I did manage last year to drop into the Grand Seiko boutique in London actually. And when I picked up my, now I was going to wear it for our episode because I know you like Seiko. So I almost wore my Seiko 5 anniversary watch. But when I went to pick up that, they actually got a few Grand Seikos out for me to have a look at, and they were just great. So I can see why people like them. Really good watches.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. And then, you know, being in the military, the big selling point that I had on this watch was, you know, I'm 3 years in line right now for the Rolex Explorer One. So same thing, well executed plain black watch. And then I started looking more into Grand Seiko, and one of what helped me kind of like pitch this to my wife is like, you know, with the 9F quartz, a battery change is every what, 3-ish years. And the movement itself is sealed and isolated. So that's a $30 change, you know, battery change that you can do anywhere, but the actual movement itself, it's a 50-year service interval. So in the long term, you know, I always have to consider cost, especially if I'm talking about watches to, you know, potential future watch enthusiasts or even soldiers that I have in my formation asking, hey, I want something more than my G-Shock. Like, I want something shiny and nice. And I do like to point to Grand Seiko. So it is a gorgeous piece.
It is gorgeous. And like I said, I think it's important as collectors and watch, you know, nerds, as it were, that, you know, when it comes to big purchases, it is to take into account servicing and all of that kind of stuff, because it all does, you know, add up a cost to, you know, what is already both an emotional and potentially very expensive, you know, we call them investments, to justify them. But you know what I mean? As an expenditure, it is a lot of money. And I do think a lot of collectors occasionally look past servicing intervals, servicing costs, and probably, you know, may or may not get stung down the line. And, you know, if you're saying that it's $30 every 3 years for battery change and pressure test, and then once probably in the lifetime that you own it, really, to have a movement service, compare that, like you said, to the Rolex Explorer, which is on average, I think, 5 to 7 years, you know.
About seven, yeah. I've seen people push it to 10. Like, and it's also the same deal, too, is just like, kind of like that peace of mind. One of the most frequent questions that I get from Cywar practitioners is like, hey, I'm trying to get into the watch game, but, you know, I don't have that watch nerd in me. I just want something that looks good and something that I can just kind of fire and forget. And I tell people that, like, you know, like, you'll see it online, like, the marketing is so strong where people look down on quartz pieces, but when you start going into Longines, you go into Grand Seiko, you go into Breitling, like, those high accuracy quartz movements, or even Citizen, it's still a engineering technical feat, you know, that they're thermal compensated. They're always accurate, and then it's cheap to maintain. So there is still that, it might not have the romanticism that most automatics and mechanicals have, but it's still got gears, it still moves. And it's still kind of like a show of how watches have progressed over the years. And finally, it's slim. Like, I haven't had a training exercise yet, but I can't wait to toss this on and do something in the winter.
Yeah, it'd be really cool. But you're right. Like you said, all those points are really valid. And it's interesting that you pulled up as well that not everyone's who wants a nice watch is a watch nerd. You know, I had that. And, you know, we're going to speak about some of your special projects as well, obviously, in this episode. But and the guys, obviously, in the audience know that I'm a big special projects kind of nerd. Like, I've led a load. I own a load. And I think they're fantastic. But, like, I had it where guys also wanted a really nice watch, didn't want an automatic because they didn't understand it or didn't want that servicing cost. And we went, like, you know, for a couple of my more recent projects, we went the quartz route because we just knew that they would work, you know. And like I said, not everybody really cares if it's quartz or automatic. They just sometimes just want something nice, right? And that's why we did it, you know. And it was funny, I had a few people turn their nose up about buying a special project because it was quartz. And it's just like, hey, that's fine. You know, I can't please everybody, but at the end of the day, the majority of people wanted it because it was just a effectively throw in on and forget, set the time. And maybe once a month, you might have to roll that crown just to change the date, you know, depending on the end of the, and, you know, the final date of the year. But that was it. Easy times. The watch that I've got on today is neither a quartz or a Grand Seiko, and it's also not a special project, but it is a watch that has its roots in the military in terms of it is a reissue. So I've got a Presidius A11 Type 32. The Type 32 on this means that it's actually I call it a carbon copy reissue of the original ones from World War II. So the 32 being its 32 mil in diameter. But on my, what I call mortal size wrists, it actually looks quite good.
Oh man, it looks fantastic.
It's cool, yeah. So what I like about it is that Oscar over at Presidius really did his research when he made this. Everything is pretty much as it would have been when it was issued to a US serviceman back in World War II. I went for the white version. So this is literally the version with no patina. So it looks as it would have looked fresh out of the store. But you can, if you want to, buy a version which has patina as if it, you know, it's old, right? So it's got that slight yellowing to the hands. What I do like about this watch, even though we're going to go into Presidius later, is the fact that it's been modernized as well. So it's got 100 meters water resistance, and it also has lume on the handset as well as the dial, whereas the original A11s didn't have lume. People forget about that because obviously when we were flying B-17s and B-24s over Europe, the navigators could just turn the lights on in the cockpit. So yeah, you didn't need lume. So there you go. That's why, you know, the aging and patina on A11s isn't as drastic as say on like a Dirty Dozen, because obviously they didn't have that radioactive radium on the hands to age in the way that obviously we are used to when we look at maybe older watches from World War II. So there you go, that's my wrist check. It's also on a new old stock Vietnam era NATO strap. So there you go. I got that from, shout out to him very quickly, Justin over at Recon Team Watch Blog. He sent me one of these because he knew it would fit and he had an extra one. So I appreciate it. It looks really cool.
Looks great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very excited, man. Would you, so for that watch, is that something that you would recommend someone that they can wear, whether they're in a field environment? Obviously, it's made for the field environment, but you think they could elevate that in a more formal setting, like let's say military functions in their nice uniform?
Oh yeah, 100%. So what's really good is, so unlike the original, some of them obviously, I know some had fixed bars and some had spring bars, depending on what case and depending on what year. But what's really good is because obviously these are modern and they have, you know, removable and also they're quick release bars, so you don't actually need to have a tool, which is really good for the straps. The bracelet option or the leather option that come from Presidius, or like I said, even aftermarket options, you just have to make sure it's obviously 16 mil on this one because it's the 32. If you buy the slightly larger version at 38 mil, the lug width is 20. So yeah, I believe that this is a watch that can definitely handle everything that you would in the field, and it also has the ability to dress up and dress down. And I think the fact that you've got interchangeable quick release spring bars means that it has that ability, you know, when we say you could put it on a rubber strap to go in the field for a week, and then you could then put it on a nice crocodile leather if you had a, I don't know, a mess function in the officer's mess, you know what I mean, you could easily do that. But I think with the black matte dial and the no date, it's always, you know, it offers a lot of symmetry in terms of its dial layout as well. I also think it would be a really good project, a really good watch for a potential project as well. So just throwing that out there.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. So yeah. Larry, before we get into your like watch journey, as it were, just give me a bit of an overview about basically yourself. I mean, I know you're currently serving in the US Army. I know you work in psychological operations from your page being Cywar Wrist Check. And we've spoken about what I do, you know, holistically, and the history of my unit, which I think is really interesting. And it ties in with a little bit about you and your career. So.
Yeah, absolutely. So I originally grew up in New Jersey, right across the Hudson River. So sometimes, like, you know, if I get excited or emotional, you might either see my Bronx personality or maybe I'm a character from Jersey Shore. You never know. It's a mixed bag. As far as, you know, what my interest besides watches, you know, love hockey. I'm a diehard Rangers fan. And your stereotypical military hobbies of like fitness, and I enjoy food, having a Filipino background. So back in the day, before I got into watches, I used to actually write reviews of different ramen places in my area, nice, just for fun, just to practice my writing, just practice that. And, you know, eventually I got into, like the more I started learning more about watches, it was like, okay, maybe I should start getting into this. But like, yeah, as we said, like I've been in psychological operations for almost 4 years now. Mm-hmm. So in total, though, I've been in the Army for 10 years. Prior to psychological operations, I was a field artillery officer. Mm-hmm. A lot of my work back in the day was target development, targeting, so whether lethal, non-lethal for effects. And that's what kind of helped me in psychological operations. So a lot of people ask, like, hey, you know, what makes a good PSYOP, you know, practitioner? And the unique thing about, you know, our profession is just we take all sorts of skill sets and apply them, because we range from the tactical PSYOP, which you'll see in those advertisement posters, you know, all, you know, in full gear in a field environment, all the way down to kind of like the strategic level where they're in their business suits or working in embassies or working with partner forces or even civilian partners. So from there, like, you start as people progress in their careers, and I've watched this between my NCOs and other officers, that, you know, what you'll see what their niche is. So for me in particular, love target development. I love kind of like figuring out, you know, what effect to deliver on a target audience, you know, what, you know, how to craft that message. I've seen people that have outstanding kind of like a creative ability, and they'll take like an ongoing kind of like military information support operation. We call it MISO. Yeah. So they'll take MISO and, you know, they'll just really amplify, like, hey, we think this target audience resonates better in social media. This should be the campaign. This is the direction that it should look. And, you know, we'll take creative people. We, you know, analytical people, because the hardest thing, right, like in kinetic warfare, you could measure the effectiveness of like an artillery strike. Yeah. 10 tanks, you know, destroyed. But when it comes to influence and then the cognitive dimension, it's like, okay, how do you measure, or how do you even observe, you know, behavior change? So, you know, we have, you know, I've served with people that are extremely analytical in the way that they just report it, charts, graphs, numbers, it blows my mind. But then at the end of the day, one of our core tenets is just communication. Because, you know, how do I take a targeting package and then explain it to a supporting commander that's never worked with the cognitive domain? Or how does that analytical person take all these numbers and then explain it in basic terms to a ambassador that doesn't know what they're talking about? But yeah, I mean, I've served in the Middle East, Asia. I've participated in joint exercises with a AFRICOM, African Command scenario. A lot of battle staffing, a lot of planning. But I've been pretty much since joining the regiment 4 years ago, it feels like every quarter I'm out the door traveling. And whether it's a planning conference or like a training event or a, you know, an actual deployment, it's all been super fun, and not every story's been the same. So that's what's keeping me in the regiment.
Yeah, I can agree with you. Like, you know, I can relate as well with some of those elements. You know, you talk about your time in joint, effectively, you know, I would refer to it as like joint effects and targeting. You know, I could relate a little bit about that back with my time with both the artillery, because in the British Army, the Royal Artillery operate our UAVs traditionally. So like, I've obviously, through targeting and imagery, I was with those, you know, with that cap badge and doing that role, so looking at the effects. And it's interesting how you went from that into psychological operations, which, you know, I can see some mirrors with my own career there, you know. But the fact that, you know, your final point really just resonated with me. You're staying in because it's fun, it's different every day, and you clearly get to travel. You know, I look at my career, and if I hadn't transferred into Army photography, or Army media, I guess now, in media comms and all of this kind of stuff that we do, I wouldn't have traveled to some of half the places that I have done since transferring across, you know. And like I said, every tasking, not necessarily, I know we always say in the military, oh, every day is different, you know, and you're not in an office 9 to 5, and I'm not in an office 9 to 5, you know, and every day is different. But obviously, clearly, there are times where days are similar to others, but I can definitely tell you that every tasking that I've done since transferring across has been different. And I think that's what's really cool. And, you know, working with different nations, different cat badges, going to see different cultures and places and operational environments has been, you know, an eye opener, even, you know, for me at the level that I am. But it's interesting that you pulled out that kind of similarity, which is really cool. I guess I've got a couple of questions just obviously, you know, before we kind of get into your watches and how that ties in with psychological operations and your page is you mentioned obviously you come from an artillery background and you got posted into the regiment. Is it a voluntarily post, as it were? Did you choose that this is how you wanted your career field to go in? So similar to me, when I, you know, did what I did in imagery intelligence and as, you know, and other things within the intelligence world. And I basically just went, I want to have a change and have a go at this selection to see if I can do this job. Was it similar for you or were you like boarded? And was it like, was your career kind of managed that way as well with suggestions? Or was it just a case of, I just want a new challenge and this looks really fun?
So to join the in the U.S. Army to join psychological operations in the active duty sense, for officers and non-commissioned officers, there is a selection process. So you do have to volunteer and you go through kind of like your first look, at least back in 2018 when I first applied, there was like a paper board. So they'll look at, hey, how did you perform in the conventional army and artillery? And from there, you go through assessment and selection. And then there, that was, you know, it's a mixed bag between physical fitness, you know, your resiliency, and then team building, and then finally problem solving. They threw a lot of really interesting problem sets at us, and they were just observing how we would react. But yeah, that is always one of the points in, at least in my field for psychological operations. So in active duty, you go to assessment and selection and you fall under special operations. So Army Special Operations, SOCOM, whatever you want to call, what, you know, all those umbrellas. And that's, and to join that is kind of like they wanted to see your baseline experience. Because for us, like, you know, we're focused on a particular capability, a particular kind of like domain that we either influence or we operate within. So they want to make sure that, hey, your baseline army stuff, you're good. You're good to go.
That's very similar. Like I said, in my, like I said, I'm just drawing parallels now, and that's very similar for us. Like, to be a military photographer, particularly in the British Army, you transfer, you have to reach a particular rank. So again, you have to be all NCOs to do it, because like you said, they take your achievement in rank as you've got a basic military experience, because like you said, we operate very niche skill set. We deploy all over to different locations, probably some, you know, sometimes as one single attached or detached person, to provide such a niche skill set that you have to be on top of the standard. You know, can you administer yourself in the field? Can you do all that other stuff? You know, but then also, you know, I've had this conversation before with like effectively civilian photographers or media specialists, and they always like, but why can't you just send a civilian? And it's just like, well, you can to certain locations, but like if for example it was an austere environment, you know, you might not be able to embed correctly with who you're telling the story or what environment you're influencing in, because you haven't got the military background, you know. And that's quite interesting again. So, you know, I'm just in my opinion, clearly psychological operations is interesting. You know, like I said, I've had an experience and exposure to it with my unit here, and obviously through our conversations and the history of it, I think clearly psychological operations practitioners are still punching way above their weight in terms of their rank and, you know, their size, because I'm clearly don't expect large units of psychological operators, as it were, you know, in the American forces. So if you come under special forces, I would assume that there's quite small teams, and it's not like, you know, you're deploying 500 people to do this job. You know, it's a lot smaller, but clearly with a big effect. So
yeah, absolutely. So that too is under special forces. So under Army Special Operations, there's different branches inside of it. So Special Forces is the Green Berets, which, you know, everyone knows about that. And then there's Civil Affairs. So that's the civil engagements between military and the host nations, civilian agencies. So whether it be, you know, local government, development, and then psychological operations is we just operate within the cognitive domain, strategic, tactical, operational messaging, working with various entities, whether it be a the U.S. Embassy or down to a supported commander in conflict. So under that, so one of the things that, you know, a lot of people see is like when they see pictures of psychological operations, like soldiers, they'll have like the special forces patch. And that's because our parent command is First Special Forces Command. So that's the, you know, the general officer command. And under that is Civil Affairs, Special Forces, and PSYOP. So that's our patch. And then in the reserve component, they fall under their own U.S. Army, Civil Affairs and PSYOP command. They support conventional units. They have their own unique patch. And that was a patch that we used to carry before we separated between active duty and reserve.
Cool. Happy. Yeah. In terms of, because you mentioned patches and obviously, you know, carrying different elements of your uniform. And I think that's a really cool spin into Psywar Risk Check as a page now. Before, like I said, and I know, you know, the guys are probably thinking it right now, get on to the watches, but I want to talk about this first. Obviously, Psywar Risk Check highlights some of the units, highlights the history of obviously American psychological operations through logos, anniversaries, and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's really cool. But, you know, just, you know, with your, obviously your experience and obviously maybe even your personal preference, you know, are there any particular units that you think have a really cool history, you know, or a really cool logo slash badge, you know, that is maybe sets them apart from, in terms of their history, from other units? Because, you know, I noticed or remember a few months or a few weeks ago at the time of recording, there was the 10th anniversary of a particular unit, you know, and I thought that was really cool that you, A, firstly highlighted it, but then I liked the fact that, you know, it was recognized with a, you know, with a effectively a mess doing a bit of a party and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah. So I guess particular badges or patches, at least from my profession, it would have to be the infamous or famous ghost. It's a Ghost Army patch. So that's under the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops. So they were a unit that was that just existed in World War II. They were a tactical deception kind of unit of action, where their sole purpose was to deceive the German forces in the Eastern campaign and the European campaign. And that patch, like, I've seen it like, even before joining PSYOP, like I've seen it everywhere. I said Underground Nine. I think I saw that patch on that plane. I've seen, you know, civilian, like law enforcement just carrying that patch that just like resonates. So a common misconception is, you know, we are not a direct descendant of the 23rd. It's just one of, you know, we just pay homage to them. Cause one of the things, you know, the biggest thing that we do is behavior change. How do you affect an adversary's decision-making calculus? And the 23rd as a tactical, tactical level unit. So say a platoon, company, battalion, you know, at the very tactical level to have broad strategic effects that actually shifted, that shaped, you know, the Normandy, the D-Day landings. And then their follow-on operations. So I think that's a really cool patch. Yeah. A lot of units in PSYOP, just because, you know, we love that story. We love how they took basically all backgrounds, actors, actresses, artists, engineers. Hey, we need you to build this stuff to tell a story to Germany, make them think one thing so we can do our actual operation. And that, I think, is like a great way to kind of tell, you know, what we do is, you know, it's hard to explain, like, okay, what are you, like, are you guys, do you guys control minds? I've read articles that they claim we do witchcraft. Like, no, we don't. Like, selected messaging, you know, in 1944, it was visual messages, inflatable tanks. Today, probably social media. And how do you kind of, like, elicit an emotion to your target audience that would make them change their behavior? Or even if it's delaying their operations, like, they see one thing, And we see this all the time in exercises. Whenever we call them the exercise gods, whenever the exercise mm-hmm. controllers throw in some sort of kind of like, I don't know, an addition of forces or something going on in the adversary side. And then you just watch the entire staff kind of like slow down, focus on that. Like that's delay in decision-making. And it's always creating space for the commands that we support.
Now, I think it's really, basically, clearly, I love the history behind it. I like the fact that your units harken back to that history as well, you know, and it's really important. And I think as well, like you said, you know, talking about how they did it back in World War II, I've got, as a part of my closing note, is a book to suggest firstly to you if you've not read it, but then obviously others if they want to know about the history of psychological operations, obviously, from the British side. So hopefully that'd be a really good suggestion. But it's interesting, you know, where we talk about the effect that we can have on a populace or a target audience, you know, without a kinetic effect, you know, being mm-hmm. done, and how important that is. And I'm going to butcher it before we move on to watches, but there was a quote in, I believe it was, it's either Skyfall or Spectre, one of the James Bond films, and it was talking about how effectively the quote is along the lines of, a 12-year-old in his bedroom with a laptop can do more damage than, you know, in an army, or, you know, I think it was some stupid, like, you know, a submarine with a nuclear missile or something, you know, like, I mean, like that. But it just shows the importance of, you know, effectively what decision making can have, and how deception and how, you know, I said having a non-kinetic effect can still have a roundabout effect in the kinetic space, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because my family, I come from a military background. My dad does not understand psychological operations in any way, shape, or form. And he just kind of lets me do what I do. He's like, yeah, as long as you're happy in your career and you're enjoying it, then that's absolutely fine. But it was interesting because he, again, not to disrespect my father and his mentality, but it's interesting that his generation are of the generation where, you know, we talk about visual communications, they're now just so used to everything coming through a phone that it's just a given, you know. And I think sometimes, you know, that generation, or my father, his case in his generation, sometimes forget that there are actually people who craft messaging through a phone and how much that has an influence and impact upon anyone who sees it, which is really interesting. All the way through this, clearly, in terms of psychological operations, timing is important, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so we talk about timing in the military construct now, of basic tactical timing, where we talk about you've got to be, you know, awake and at a location for a meeting on a certain time and all this kind of stuff, right? But, you know, clearly, as a serving military member, you pretty much always have a watch on, right? Since you get up, you know, it's basically from you wake up to go to sleep. And obviously, clearly, when you're on operations, you don't take your watch off at all. But, like, are there any standout watches that you have got throughout your career before we get onto some of the more special watches, particularly, you know, your really cool Christopher Ward?
So I'll always give my shout out to my my very first watch. It was a Casio A-80 whiskey. That was a watch my mom gave me when I left for college, kept it on. And then when I was in the service, you know, like, it was definitely a tool watch. I timed my runs. You know, it had a minute repeater. So whenever we were doing, you know, training exercise, like, it would beep the time to me if I couldn't use Loom, because, you know, you don't want our training graders to say, hey, noise and light discipline. The little beep was soft enough.
Yeah.
And then definitely, like, the alarm saved my butt a ton of times for formation. but the one that got me into my watches is my Seiko SKX007. So I initially got, so what went from just being a tool that I use without thinking about it to something that I'm more proactive in researching. When I was a platoon leader in the artillery world, one of my homies, he received as a graduation gift his dad's Rolex Submariner.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
It was his family's tradition that a college graduate received, like the males received a nice timepiece, and his dad just gave him his Rolex. And I just knew Rolex, like, brand recognition, but then I kind of paid attention to kind of like the movement, and I saw, oh, that secondhand is kind of cool. So then he recommended, he's like, hey, Seiko's the way to go. It's cheapest. Like, you don't want to invest on something that you're not really bought in. So back in 2015, the SKX was only $140. So that would be 80 British pounds, maybe.
Yeah.
I think that's,
yeah,
that's
just my, it's just about, like, it's probably just about that. Yeah. Like it's, it was, there were no more than £100 back in, 2015.
Yeah. Back in the day.
Yeah. Whoever thought, whoever thought that we'd ever see SKXs over £400, like, that's mental.
Oh, it blows my mind. I always have my, I have my profile on Chrono 24 and it'll show you like the market value of that watch. And it blows my mind. Like, man, I could really flip this SKX. But to go back to your question, like that's, I call it my war watch. It's been a war baby. Ever since I wore it, like every deployment, I've always left the country with that watch. I've done operations in that watch and it's survived pretty much everything. When it came down to accuracy, like me, I mean, we have our equipment, our computers, our tools. Okay, yeah, I have to be somewhere on the dot, but to be the plus minus 25 second accuracy, you know, as long as it's in the minute, I'm in the ballpark. Mm-hmm. That's all I really cared about. Yeah. And if for something more precise, like we had our other equipment.
Yeah, exactly.
And then in the military, you always show up, what, 4 hours early for the rehearsal to the thing to happen.
Like, yeah.
It always comes out. Yeah,
you're always there on time because you're made to be there. A lot earlier,
yeah.
It's but, the old adage of hurry up and wait. If I remember correctly,
absolutely, that is pretty much the slogan of the military. I'm pretty sure across the world is like.
Yeah, I'm glad it's an international slogan. I'm glad it's not just me who's had to, get to the airhead at a certain time for a flight 8 hours later. Like, absolutely ridiculous. So.
Oh yeah. And then I have my like inherent anxiety, like, oh, what if I sleep in? So I'll subtract another hour to say, oh, what if I get lost? Or what if, you know, there's traffic, like there's all this paranoia. So I'm always like 6 hours early. I just sit there and hurry up and wait.
Yeah, exactly. You sit there crying in your poor decision of getting there that early, but you know, you're there then. In terms of your 007, obviously, really cool watch, and you've taken it all over the world, as you've said. Has it also clearly developed a really nice ghosted patina on that bezel?
Oh, absolutely. Here, let me pull her out. So she's got, there she is. So a lot of dings and scratches, featuring a Cincy strap. So the NATO shot is from Cincy Strap Company. Recommendation from actually one of my top contributors in the page. Never really considered the NATO style bond, but once I threw this on here, it really changed the game. And I've been wearing this a lot more frequently now, but in terms of patina, I would say there's so much sand in the bezel that I can't turn it. People say it's a really easy fix, but I'm like,
nah,
it's heritage. It's history.
Yeah. You're like, that's my history. Like, that's I like that. Have you ever had it serviced though, or pressure tested since you bought it? Because you know, this is the thing, right? Seiko SKXs are just bomb proof. They just go forever. Like, you know, in my experience, you don't have to service them. Like, but you know, I mean, is that something that you've had to do yet or not?
I haven't. As long as I call it Larry's tolerance. If it's within 2 minutes, I think I'm straight. It's been on par. Like, I wore this all day yesterday and I was actually just comparing it to the atomic time. And I think I was only losing about 30 seconds.
That's still in terrible. No, it's not terrible. It's still in the ballpark of what Seiko made them in. So you're all right. Yeah. You're all good.
Yeah.
So that's the watch that obviously got you started on your watch collection journey and all that kind of stuff. So when did the special project watches start coming in? You know, how did that come into the collection for you? You know, was it a case of you went into work one day and there was, because for me, it was that. So I went into work one day and noticed other people, because I had been collecting for a few years by this point, I'd noticed other people had some nice watches on. And then I started hearing, you know, conversations about, oh, look at this one. This is, you know, got a different logo. This is because I qualified in this. Or was it also a little bit more open where it was, you were having a coffee in the tea bar, for example, and you noticed someone had put up a flyer with a poster saying, you know, please sign up this project. It's a special watch. You know, how did that come about for you?
So for me, like with watches having such a deep and rich history in the military, I started following the Instagram page, Watches of Espionage, and sometimes we'll talk offline and just kind of, either talk you know, professionally or even more about watches. And that was when I first started realizing that a lot of units across the world will have their own kind of like special project in, you know, paying tribute to that unit. You know, everyone, this unit received this. And I always heard rumors that, hey, if you go into, so for example, I've served with some guys in Australian SOF, and, you know, there's particular units where when you leave that unit, you receive a Breitling, I think it was an Avenger. It was an Avenger. And it had like, it had very subtle kind of marks to kind of identify, whether it be in the case back or it'll be engraved on the side. So I've always, so as like kind of my interest in watches grew, the more I read into it, the more I started kind of tying it to psychological operations and messaging and behavior change. It blows my mind how much the watch market has evolved into. How do you convince someone to buy a piece of technology that your phone can do a lot better, or you can get for $15 in you know, the local commissary? And you know, how do, like, how? Because it's, we're not even asking for 300-400 pound watch. You know, you're looking at Jaeger LeCoultres and they're up there in the five.
Sorry, guys, just so you're aware, I've just shown Larry the Inkor Avenger, because I'm assuming that was similar to the Australian one. But you're right though. How do you affect that behavior? How do you influence that mindset to go, I'm going to drop $2,500?
Yeah.
Because that's what it is.
It is. And if you're looking at the civilian market, a lot of them say, hey, this watch pays, this watch has exact specifications to this military, or or like the Cartier Santos was like, hey, this was the first wristwatch made for men initially for pilots, like that nice unique story. But anyway, I started seeing more watch companies changing their design cues. Like a lot of the micro brands, they look similar. All watches are going to look pretty similar. I'm pretty sure every design cue has been made, but they have little subtle changes that make it kind of stand out. And that's when I was actually taking a course on social media marketing, just kind of hone in on my messaging skills. And the central topic to kind of my thesis to that class was watch brands, watch marketing, looking at how Tudor is involved and how Tudor has, I will argue from my from my point of view, is Tudor is no longer, isn't really under Rolex's shadow anymore. Like it's its own brand.
It's definitely its own brand. I think you've seen that change, haven't you? You know, for want of a better expression, you've seen that behavioral change from its reinception in 2015-14 to now. You know, it's basically 10 years now since they've come back as a separate entity. And you can see how, you know, they went from that born to there, and they had, you know, their designs to set at what they were set for a very long time, and they pushed a particular product, the Black Bay, you know, and then they dipped out, didn't they, with that experimentation with stuff like the P01 and the North Flag. And now, like you said, you know, they're a completely different beast, you know, to to what they were. And, you know, you're right, you know, they're definitely not a subsidiary of the bigger brother by any way stretch of the imagination, you know.
But then to start, you know, special projects, like, I've loved watches. Like I love watches to a point where it's like, hey, what if I could design something that would sell to everyone? You know, when I started the watch page, and my core followers are fellow homies and friends, you know, within the regiment, or that I've served with that are already into watches. They're already bought in. They're ambassadors. But then I was curious as to seeing, okay, how can I design a watch that would attract, you know, the newest soldiers in the regiment into saying, okay, yeah, my G-Shock is fine, but that looks cool. I want to buy that. And I've been looking at various design cues across between the uniqueness of how Grand Seiko executes their dials. I like how the simplicity of it, I would say a lot of the Swiss watches are moving towards, that they're trying to make something simple look great, like the more you look at it. So to talk about, you know, Christopher, the first, we call it Cy Ward. So Christopher Ward and Cy Ward. So I'll bring it out. So I was one of the first customers for it. So this is the actual Christopher Ward model is the C63 Sealander automatic.
Yeah.
It's got the Salida 200 Sellita 200 Whiskey 1 automatic movement. It's got the time and date complication. But what stuck out about this is the asking price was £705, $800 for this one without a bracelet. You're looking at $1,000 for with the bracelet. And I when the original our forefathers of the sideward were designing it, they nailed the just the simplicity of a textured green dial, just the rook chess piece, and then it just says sideward, and it really spoke out. And people will see it and, oh my goodness, that's a really nice watch. You know, are you guys going to do another resale? I was like, I don't know. Let me ask, you know, the originators. And as soon as I mentioned the price, they're kind of like, ugh, like, yeah, that's a lot of money. So that's where I built the Instagram page. And it's all kind of like, and it's all got a strategy behind it. I started out by showing off my watch, my cheapo. This is what got me into watches. And then I started, so I would do these informed posts, like what is a quartz watch? What is a mechanical hand-wound watch? What is watch? What is a automatic watch? And I'm trying to educate people in the most layman's terms possible on why this matters or why people would spend money on this. Eventually, you know, the more I educate people, that kind of at the same time, you know, I asked the original guys in the regiment, hey, can I do an iteration of Sidewar? And that's when, once I got the blessing off of that, I started paying attention to design cues. Like I'd wear different watches to work, and I was actually just seeing what people liked, what they disliked. And you know, and that's where it led to the GMT, because at that price point, you know, the cool thing, especially new watch people can say, is, well, it tracks two time zones automatically. That big green arrow is another time zone. And there is practical applications, because I've had days at work where, you know, where someone's always asking, hey, let's call up so-and-so who's stationed out in Hawaii. Instead of sitting there doing the math or Googling it, like I would look down at my GMT and like, yep, this is the time. So that was one way that I kind of did my whisper campaign when I was initially designing it. And then I went with the black dial, like as you can see in the page, because it's very versatile. To some people, to me, I don't care. Like you and I'll wear the brightest yellow watch in a suit. I don't care. But I know to some people, black, you know, the black dial is subtle, it's neutral, it's good to go.
And like you said, and also the other side of it is for some people, this will potentially be their one nice watch, like you said. So it's got to be versatile to go with all the different situations that they find themselves in. So I get it, you know, but I like it. I think it's really cool. On the subject of obviously that, you know, the Sidewar 2, for want of a better term, the GMT, what's interesting is obviously we started messaging probably a couple of months ago, and then I got a sense, obviously clearly guys, I'm going to caveat it at the time of recording, a PDF. My previous job spec have just launched two watches with, or say launched, are launching or planning to launch two watches with Christopher Ward as well. One based on the C63 and one based on the C60 Diver. And I just think actually the designs are really different. You know, I mean, like I said, there's not a lot on the dial, you know, but for me, I think the coolest bit on the design is actually the case back. You guys, you know, I assume on the GMT as well, it's got a clear case back, but with a design on it.
So this one is, no, this one is the solid case back with the Ghost Army patch on it. So it's kind of, we like the theme of these Sidewar watches is unity between active and reserve, you know, unity amongst the professionals. And the one symbol that kind of like resonates with us is that Ghost Army patch, whether people know the history or not, they think it's really cool. So yeah, that's why we went with that one.
No, it's cool. Yeah, it's really cool. In terms of that watch then, you know, clearly X amount were sold. They've gone off to their owners, for want of a better expression. Do you notice other people within the regiment wearing it? Like, was there a bit of a buzz of excitement when these things started turning up in the mail? You know what I mean?
When the order was first closed, I just remember it was myself and I think six or seven of our friends that were asked, hey, would you be interested in this? We were stalking our mailboxes for about 2.5-3 months. And then as soon as it arrived, you know, the confirmation bias, like I would see it with the people that I knew that purchased it. And then I can still recall random soldiers and officers in my office that would look at it. And then they ask, hey, that's a nice watch. Can I see it? And then as soon as they see the logo, what it says, and then the case back, they're like, holy shit. Like, what is, what? When was this? How do I get in on this? And then the nice part is the original 25 that purchased it. I'll see someone that wears the exact same green watch. And I know it's interesting that the people, from what I'm told, the people that were involved in this watch are people in this watch order are either watch aficionados that will spend the money, but also people that are trusted or it was all like a enclosed friend circle. So I've came across two high ranking guys that were wearing this watch, and I didn't have to do like a baseline background check. Like I already knew this person's like a professional. That's good. Like if they resonate with my homies, I guess this guy's my homie. And there was kind of like that. Now I get it. That kind of like,
It's like a secret handshake, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And now soldiers are all about it. And when I was doing this PSYOP watch order, a lot of them were just saying, man, that's a lot of money. And even for higher ranking individuals, they're saying, man, that's a lot of money, but you know what? I'll make it my retirement watch.
Yeah.
And one thing that stuck out with this watch is that, you know, I will always highlight, and I'll appreciate the original guys from doing it, is I've never seen so many people proud of the regiment that they would actually consider crossing that line and buying a watch with the logo of the unit, something that they'll wear all the time, you know, that they'll invest in. And with the Christopher Ward, I call it the second iteration, it was actually from students in the Cywar schoolhouse that they haven't even done a mission. Like they're still in, but they're so excited and so bought into the regiment and our profession and what we do that they invested time and a lot of money in releasing their C60 watches. And that was something that stuck out to a lot of us that have been in the regiment for a minute. So that's why like, I would like to continue doing this and making watch releases for people while also continuing to educate people that this is why someone would spend thousands on a Rolex. And this is why someone will spend money on a Christopher Ward. And what I appreciate about them is that pound for pound, based on the finishing and how much I've abused this already, its durability, it punches way above its weight class. Like I love their business model that they don't go, I think, three times over the cost of making each piece.
I think, like I said, they offer a lot of watch for the money, don't they? And and the fact that you can have something, a piece unique, for want of a better expression, on that, on top of that as well, I think is more the better, you know what I mean? I'm a big advocate for special projects. It's interesting, you know, again, drawing parallels again, you know, how you're saying how it got people excited in the office, it got students who were yet to qualify excited. You know, one of my projects that I launched years back, was actually my first project, was with Bremont, and it obviously it commemorates the history of imagery intelligence within the UK military. And what was interesting and what was really cool was I managed to get the flyers and the information into the instructor house, effectively into the wing where we learn obviously the art of imagery intelligence, for want of a better expression. And it was cool to see, like you said, a couple of guys who hadn't qualified yet but were so like to keyed up to go into that role, but like you said, they committed to the watch. You know, later on down the line, I've done a few other projects with another company, and you know, did a completely different watch, you know, a different price point, you know, and a wider release. And again, it's exactly the same. What was really cool was seeing those behind me in terms of, you know, career you know, development and you know, and see them buy into it. But then also what was really cool was seeing retired veterans, you know, having the ability to buy it, as and then getting an email back saying, you know, this commemorates, like you said, 25 years of my life, you know, to the core. You know, I've engraved it with my, I don't know, the year I started, or the, you know, the date that I commissioned, or the date that I enlisted in. And it's just nice thing that brings a load of people together, which, like you said, normally, you know, without being in the military, probably law enforcement, search and rescue, you probably don't have that sense of community anyway. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Or the only place, other places to get that sense of community is in those fields, you know? And I think that's what's really cool is that it's something as small as a watch. And like you said, yes, it's a emotional and quite a high, you know, cash, you know, amount sometimes can bring people together, you know? And mm-hmm. I think that's what's really cool. And like you said, you know, these are things that people can wear, you know, until they retire, past their retirement, and, you know, hopefully be things that are handed down to the next generation. And, you know, they'll have and they'll carry stories from, you know, whoever's handed it down potentially as well, you know. Yeah. And it's so much cooler, I think, to be handy. Admittedly, your colleague who was handed down his father's Rolex Submariner, really cool story because it's his dad's watch, right? You know, he would have grown up mm-hmm. watching his dad wear that, you know, doing everything from cutting the grass to driving the car to doing whatever he did in his real job. And he'll have those memories. But I think when you can hand down a special project potentially and have that extra connotation to what does this mean? What does this commemorate? As well as, oh, it's my dad's. I think just is a really cool story, you know, and clearly that's me romanticizing it, right, to justify yeah. these things. But the fact that there are those, you know, parallels, you know, with my service and your service and the people that we work with, I think is really cool.
Yeah. You made a comment earlier that stuck out to me. You mentioned, like, or you were asking, hey, why, you know, with watches, why is that important to the psychological operations mm-hmm. measurement? Why, you know, why is that a big thing, right? Like, you know, we're not special forces where we have to be on the objective at this exact time. Yeah. But, you know, for me, what I've seen is I've seen watches, especially in the military and then the civilian communities, as kind of like an icebreaker. Yeah. And for us, right, to even get in the door, I've noticed across every service, you know, I'll see one or two guys with a Rolex or an Omega. Mm-hmm. I've seen a JLC, Memovox. Never seen one in the wild, but that initiated a conversation. And some of the younger guys will ask, like, you know, why are watches like that important to you? It was like, yeah, it's a personal hobby, but at the same time too, I will wear my nicest or the most, wherever I go, I'll wear what I think will resonate in that community, because people will notice that, hey, that's a nice watch. And then at that point we can start talking, start to get to know each other instead mm-hmm. of just going right into business. You know, especially in Western society, we like to go straight cut to the chase. But mm-hmm. you know, I don't even know who you are. But then if I see, hey, yeah, you're a watch guy. What's that? Yeah. Oh, this is a PSYOP watch. Oh, that's cool. And that's been nice.
And like you said, there's more of a conversation starter. And like you said, that icebreaker. And I find as well with special projects, particularly, you know, and I'll go back and talk about my Elliot Brown project for the Intelligence Corps. As a really good example. So, like, we sold over 100 of those watches. You know, I don't know all of the 100 people who have bought those watches, right? But what is really cool is, you know, in the role that I'm now in, obviously not being in the intelligence corps, what's really cool is I'm on the fringes of that world still. And what's really cool is I see that watch occasionally. And like you said, you can have that conversation and say, oh, yeah, that's a really cool watch. And talk about it, and then actually, like you said, go into the business side of it and say, Archie, I'm here to do this, can you help me out? And like I said, 9 times out of 10, you know, in my experience, where I've spoken to other people who have never met before who have had that watch, it's always been a positive engagement, because it's almost like giving someone a compliment, right? It's like, yeah, I like your style, that's really cool, whatever. And like I said, that secret handshake, or it'll be, oh yeah, I got it because of this. And then you'll talk about the brand for a little bit, and then like you said, you'll go into what you actually need to do. But what's really cool is, like I said, for me, I've had everyone from a veteran right through to current serving of all ranks, and then like I said, guys who haven't even qualified talk to me about that watch, you know, and it's just really cool, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of Cywar now and the future, because clearly, you know, you designed this GMT, and it's obviously the order books are closed on that now. So obviously, firstly, clearly you're still scanning your inbox for when that's going to get delivered, because I know I was the moment like the order books closed, I did like the whole I won't bother them for a month. I mean, it's just like, yeah, I'm going to start bothering them now. See, you know, how that project develops. But what I've really enjoyed when I've led a special project is seeing, you know, effectively an idea in my head turned into a digital render that turned into a list of people that turned into, you know, a photo of, I don't know, a dial sample. And then that turned into a watch. And then that turned into these things turning up. you know, I get excited about seeing an idea turn into reality, right? I assume that's a similar case for you, but I guess with the GMT watch, you're now just at that point where you're just waiting for something to be delivered because the order books have closed.
Yes. And yeah. I feel that, so bad because
it's a long time, right?
It is. And I feel terrible because people were asking, like, well, what's the turnaround time from the orders closing? When the first one came out, it was 3 months from flash to bang. So place the order, 3 months later, it was on our doorstep. But that was for 25 watches. Yeah. So for this one, I'm at over 60, 70 watches. And I always forget that everything is handmade, hand designed. You know, there's a lot that goes into it. And I've stopped bothering Mr. France. I'm just going to hit the trust button and it'll come out. So for anyone that's following the page, just hopefully we've gotten, you know, because of recording timing, we've heard something by now. But what's that called? And that's something that's interesting too, is just like when you go to these bespoke watches and like with Christopher Ward and how much time and care they put into it. Yes. That's why I'll always, you know, if I work on projects in the future, continue working with Christopher Ward.
Yeah. I think as well, like the mindset for a company to take a project like this, right? So, you know, I'll talk about it from my experience with Bremont and with Elliot Brown, you know, both those companies, you know, very similar to Christopher Ward in the fact that, you know, clearly British, right? You know, talk about British watchmaking as well as a big thing within my own personal collection. But like for a company to take a special commission, right, and put effectively take your heritage of whatever unit, trade or sub-organization you are and go, actually, I think we can do a design justice to your heritage and put our name on it. I think people forget that's actually quite a big thing for them as well. You know what I mean? They're putting their name on something that is so unique. You can't get away with effectively, like I said, cutting corners or having poor customer service or having poor, you know, quality control, because fundamentally, like, these people have invested a percentage of money for something so unique that can only be a Christopher Ward when it's finished and being is seen by other people. It can only be an Elliot Brown, it can only be a Bremont, you know. And those companies are judged, right, by firstly the owners, like by the actual entity, the actual item, but then also how well they have engaged with the customer, the client, you know, whether you sing your praises of these companies or not. Obviously, in my experience, I can only say that I've had fantastic experiences with all the companies that I've had special projects with, be it as a project leader or as a applicant for a special project, you know. But I have also heard, you know, in the past, you know, other people have had different experiences to me, you know. So that must be, you know, for their point of view as a company now, a really big thing, you know, to kind of put their, you know, to hang their hat on and say, actually, we're good enough to do the psychological operations regiments watch, you know. I think that people forget that, right? You know what I mean? Like I said, it's a long time. It's a long time to have these things made, and we get excited as watch nerds or just people who just want something really nice. But yeah, I bet there's an element of anticipation to an extent with the companies where they kind of go, oh, I never thought that we'd ever make a watch for the psychological operations regiment of the US Army. That's really cool that we've got 60 watches into that entity, you know, that we never would have had if it wasn't for, you know, effectively putting our name, you know, our hanging our hat on the fact that we have the ability to make these things. And I think, you know, like I said, people, I think, you know, we need to give them credit as well for taking our projects on, for want of a better expression.
Absolutely. And that actually is a really good point, because so for the first, so here, so I'll just show it up. So for the first Christopher Ward, I will give them all the credit in the world, because they designed this watch where on the dial, it doesn't say Christopher Ward anywhere. They were letting their work speak for itself. I mean, it's on the crown. I mean, their logo's on the crown. So when I did the design for the GMT version, I was like, no, throw Christopher Ward on there. Put that logo right below the hand, below the hands. Because one, I think of all the micro brands, I don't even think they're micro brand anymore, because I read, hear, see about them all the time now.
Yeah, I think they're considered. Yeah, I think they would be considered an independent now. You know, more than a micro. I think, like I said, I don't know. You know, this is a quick side shuffle, but I would say micro brand is a bloke in his bedroom. For what effects, you know, if you know what I mean, like, no disrespect to those guys who do it, because I, you know, I'm jealous, I wish I could make watches, you know, instead of going to work to do what I do. Not that I hate my job, but like, I sit there and kind of go, like, that's really cool, you know. But I would say that micro brand is like an individual small entity potentially viewed as being at home. And I think an independent brand is probably something that's like at least registered, right? It's got multiple mm-hmm. employees, and it has, in my opinion, like as a watch guy, I'd say it also has the ability to do like returns and servicing, like, but with warranties, you know, instead mm-hmm. of just your watch is not great, I will either fix it or I'll send you a replacement. But you know what I mean? I think where in my opinion, where a micro brand and an independent differ, I think it comes back to customer service, quality control, and longevity with servicing. But that's just my opinion. Mm.
Yeah, I actually agree. That's yeah. actually a really good way to put about it, because people ask like, okay, what's Christopher Ward? Because like in my office on my desk, I have various mm-hmm. watch magazines. That's like my reading piece when people hang out in the office.
Yeah.
And people will start seeing, you know, Christopher Ward pieces in different magazines, or even like the Loop, their actual publication. And they're like, well, you know, why don't I ever see this in the mall, or why don't I ever see this like on massive advertising? And that's when I'll start explaining to them that they're literally relying on the quality of their watches and their mm-hmm. marketing to keep costs down from the customer's end, while also producing the best products and still going to the point that they can even innovate and move forward. Mm-hmm. Like even with the, I can't even think off the top of my head, C65, whatever one has the integrated bracelet.
I think it's the C65.
Yeah. And it's a gorgeous piece, and it's them competing with the current trend in the big watch world of integrated bracelets. So that's what I really appreciate about that.
Yeah, no, I agree. In terms of, so before we move on to future for Saiwa and future projects, in terms of Christopher Ward now and your experience, and for anyone potentially listening who may want to approach Christopher Ward, have you got any like hints and tips, or is it just a case of guys just email and they'll talk you through the process?
So I asked, the guy that initially designed Saiwa 1, I asked him, hey, I would like to follow your trend, right? And how did you reach out to Christopher Ward? He actually gave me Mr. France's contact info. And at the time when I was working, I got excited one night. I was like, you know what? I'm going to pull that trigger. And I couldn't find my notebook that I had his email written in. Yeah. So I just reached out to the website itself. So if you go to Bespoke Watches, you email it. Within 24 hours, they reached back and said, hey, what are you looking at? We see you've worked, or you're a customer of one of our Bespoke Watches. So they walked you through the process up until Mr. France was working with me point to point. Mm-hmm. And when it came to the design cues, I started out with, hey, this is what I'm looking at. Very kind of like I'm in control. And then eventually Mr. France said, hey, when it comes to the finishing or whatever, this is what we recommend. So my tip is, obviously, whatever you're dreaming of, wherever you put the logo, whatever it is, always express that. But if Christopher Ward wants to give a creative recommendation, just let it happen. Because at the end of the day, you know, they get paid. They get paid the big bucks to do the designing. And what I always forget is, you know, my initial vision for the GMT was this one thing. But what the product you're seeing now resonates to me and to the broader audience. Because I have shown my concept before, and some people are like, well, I don't like that color of the second hand. It's like, oh, okay.
That's
my biggest advice is, or my two pieces of advice is being patient, and then also allowing them to give them some of the creative control and make recommendations, because you might see something that you can't even dream of or wouldn't even consider.
Yeah, I did something similar with my project. So I went with a rough design, because they had no idea about what job they had to commemorate. And then with the other one, I literally just gave them like a potted history of what the job was and what we were. And I just was like, you know, like you said, you know, you guys get paid to actually design watches. Clearly, you're going to go off and design it, and then you'll give me a starter, you know, and then we can work on it from there. And I've always found in my experience that it is a two-way conversation. And like I said, and if the company turns around and says, oh, we actually can't do that because of X, Y, and Z, or actually, have you thought about it in this way? Like you said, it's because they want to enhance their product, right? They know what it's like to make a watch. So they know what looks good on a dial or the position on something on a dial. And like you said, I think it needs a good project leader, like you said, needs to have patience and two-way conversation in order to get the best out of you know, your product. And, you know, I would also agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the project then, do people just have to follow you for any more updates on the GMT? I assume you're like, you know, I'm sure the page is a really good place. If they're not going to get updates directly from CW all the time, that, you know, you're a good point of contact, and the page is always a good place to drop by for any updates on the project.
Absolutely. The quickest way is in the DMs at the page, or if they're more comfortable, they can email me at cywarriswristcheck@gmail.com.
Okay.
So
yeah.
I do check both accounts mm-hmm. frequently, but I'm mostly on Instagram because
it's quicker, right?
Talking to guys like, yeah, it's a lot faster.
It's faster. Yeah, that's fine. All right, guys. If you bought the project, you know, and you're impatient, obviously hit up Larry on Instagram. So there you go. In terms of future projects now, Larry, you teased something and I'm really excited. And obviously, clearly talk about influence and influencing the environment. I, you know, put a bit of a foreshadowing on the episode with my own wrist check. So I know that you have, you know, started the design phase with Presidius for a watch. Mm-hmm. So talk to me a little bit about that, you know, why you went for Presidius, you know, what watch you've gone for. And then, you know, is there any, you know, details for people if they wish to sign up?
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah. Hey, if you're assigned to the PSYOP regiment and have listened this far, thank you from both of us. But I've been working with Presidius Watch Company for the 2024 PSYOP watch drop. So my kind of like campaign, if you will, is every odd year, so 2023, 2025, and so on, will be with Christopher Ward. I think Christopher Ward is the brand, like that a lot of us agree that it's the brand, the quote unquote, the higher end luxury brand for the PSYOP watches. Whereas the even years, I'd like to kind of retell PSYOP's story through more attainable prices. So with Presidius, I'm going to start it with World War II. Fun fact to people who don't know, in World War I, they use pocket watches, and I'm not designing one. That's not happening.
No, and the thing is, it only ever get used in mess functions.
Yeah. And I'm glad that that was your wrist check for today, because I've never seen 34 millimeters on the wrist.
Yeah.
Looks fantastic, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. But I went with the Presidius Watch Company because I've always wanted to tinker with the A11 design. Mm-hmm. With PSYOP playing a huge role in World War II across the Allied forces, we can assume, or it's actually fact, that any service member in World War II under the US was issued the A11 series watch. Mm-hmm. So they helped me design this watch under their A11 Type 44 homage in 38 mm-hmm. millimeters. That is more of a customer feedback. A lot of my guys don't want to wear anything below 36. So, all right, sure, 38. So for this design, it's like just like yours, we went with the white version rather than the patina kind of design. So the hours, markers, hands, and is all just like the original A11. So except in matte embossed green, so a very dark PSYOP green, are the Arabic numbers 2, 4, 7, and 8 hour markers. So that's highlighting the 4 PSYOP groups in the U.S. Army. Second group and seventh group being in the reserve component, and fourth and eighth in the active duty special operations component. Below the 12 o'clock. So I sent you the photo, Dan.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now as you talk through. Because like I said, I could have, you know, asked you about the design before we start recording, but I actually wanted to learn as obviously other people were listening. Talk me through it. I'm looking at it. It's really cool, by the way.
Oh, I appreciate it. Below the 12 o'clock is the same matte embossed green text, PSYOP. And just above the 6 is the PSYOP insignia of the Rook chest piece with the cross lightning bolt daggers. So the back, it's going to be an exhibition case back. So I think that photo I sent you, it's going to be the closed case back, but we went with the exhibition case back to showcase the Seiko NH35 auto movement, which is an upgrade to my SKX 007. So this one is even more bulletproof, except you can hack now. So you can stop the seconds hand for those who aren't, you know, educated enough, aren't educated on the automatic movements.
Mm-hmm.
And the laser engraving is the Ghost Army patch. And then right above it is the PSYOP that. So you've seen, you might have seen it in some of the Special Forces patches. So we'll have that, and then the Airborne's have in the Special Forces. So for us, we have Psy War. It's not in uniform, but it is something that we do appreciate, and it's something that we do all kind of like unite around. Is like, oh, I wish the big army would let us wear like a Psy War tab. So anyway, this watch pays homage to the, again, the Ghost Army during World War II, with the ghost patch floating everywhere in the regiment. So what's key here, like I mentioned earlier, is the Ghost Army was a tactical level unit that shaped Germany's decision making. We do have more direct ties to General Robert A. McClure, his Psy War section in the European campaign. But the Ghost Army is like the Ghost Army is actually an honorary member of the regiment. So for me to tell the regiment story, in my opinion, our most important echelon right now is a Psy War detachment or the Psy Det. It's not the company, it's not the battalion, it's not the group. I think it's the detachment because they're the guys that are doing the work. And like you said, punching above their weight class for the number of guys out there. So another fun fact is, So under the command, force generation, and guidance of the four Psy War groups, our detachments do provide massive effects. So I want this release to not only showcase the cool patch, but pay tribute to the Ghost Army, but retell the impact of our effects in the cognitive space through the dial Y2, 4, 7, and 8 are highlighted. So with the sapphire crystal, green super loom painted only over the 2, 4, 7, and 8 markers. The watch, I think when I saw the graphic draw, like the image you're looking at, I think it looks fantastic. And working with Presidius, they're asking $250 USD. So extremely attainable to the regiment. It could be like, hey, I'm an avid watch collector. $250 is literally pennies to my Seamaster, or the new person says, I want one nice watch. And let's say $200 is my limit, and that would be it. So details on this release, right? So the prototype for approval should be within February, so next month. I'm intending to open the sales first week of March with delivery by next summer. So Dan, fun fact, when we were talking history, both offline and when we were recording, so as I was going through Psy War's history, you know, the British deception and Psy War campaign and Operation Betram in 1942, and the British political warfare executive within General McClure's Psy War section, they were huge in helping build who we are today. A lot of stuff from the Ghost Army came from British action. So obviously, you're a brother, so you're totally welcome to purchase one if you're interested.
You absolute hero. I will definitely purchase one. That is not a problem. And what I'll do as well, you know, clearly on recording, we've clearly dropped your release on this recording. This is going up, you know, clearly it's gone up when people listen to it. But, you know, all the future updates as well, I'll help share it out as well, because at the end of the day, I just love special projects. Clearly, you know, with our, you know, similar career streams and our unit backgrounds, you know, it's only right that I do so. But I tell you what, looking at the design from Oscar over at Presidius, I think he has managed to emulate and capture the history of US Army psychological operations in such a punchy yet very simple and simple, not to take away, detract from its, you know, its design, right? And I think simple is the correct way, is the fact that I've seen a lot of special projects in the past where they've got a lot of intricate designs that unless you know that niche bit of the history, you'll never understand it. And I think this is very simple. Like you said, it shows the reserve and their active regular units. It has, you know, the unit crest on it, Psy War, and then you've got the tabs, and, you know, it, in a package of $250. Yeah, phenomenal.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point, right? It's just phenomenal. And also, having worked with Oscar, I've done some product photography for Oscar in the past, and I also and the audience know this, so if you've heard this story before, you're gonna hear it again. I don't care. I'm not even gonna ask for forgiveness, but I helped Oscar with the recon release back in 2023, so last year. And how I helped him with that was effectively I sent him a MacV SOG Seiko, which was 3D printed effectively and scanned in order for them to make their recon iterations. Obviously, they scaled the watch up because, like you said, you know, customer feedback is, you know, people like, you know, they don't mind traditionally sized watches, but I think 36 and smaller only really fits on my wrist and like proper watch aficionados, whereas, you know, these guys want watches to sell, right? You know, they're a business. You know, they scaled the Seiko up effectively, the case, to 38 mil, and then they've made the recon watch. But what was really cool was at the back of helping with that, that watch, the original, ended up going back to John Strikenmeyer, who is a MacVSog veteran. So we managed to get a MacVSog Seiko back on the wrist of a MacVSog veteran. And on his personal story, he actually lost his original issued Seiko in the surf when I think he was bodyboarding or surfing in like California or on the East Coast. I can't remember which coast he was on. And it fell off, like his strap like just went, you know, and he lost it.
Oh,
so,
no.
You know, back in the 70s. So he got through his entire deployment, you know, with MacVSog or multiple deployments and operations with MacVSog, came back with this watch, which, like you said, is just embodied his time as an operator, and then to lose it in the surf after the war. And the fact that we've managed to get, you know, me and Oscar, you know, worked together, did some product photography, helped him with his development of the recon watch, and managed to get this watch back to a veteran, for me, is really good. But also shows you the caliber of Presidius as a company, right? They care about the people they work with, and also, like, I don't know, clearly, you know, I don't know because I'm not involved in this project, but, you know, if there is a charitable element to it, I'm sure Oscar would do something like that. And, you know, and I think that's a really good thing as well. You know, you're giving back to your community in a nice thing, but then also you're going to good people to do it. And I think that's great.
No, absolutely. And then also for any listeners that follow my page, these watches are assembled in the USA. You know, often we see a lot of watches made in Switzerland, made in Japan, made in England, but this one is hand assembled in the USA. And I think that that's another piece of symbolism that matters to, you know, soldiers. And I think that's awesome that, you know, you guys did, I read about it and I heard in one of your podcasts, and I think that's a fantastic story, because MacVSog is another kind of we pay a lot of historical tribute to them with what they did out there. So, oh no, is this a hint for 2026? But yeah, that's how I'm trying to retell the story. But yeah.
No, it's really cool, man. I think that design will sell. I can see the appeal to it. And I think you like I said, you and Oscar, because obviously clearly there's an element of you giving him, you know, what you want on it, and him, you know, doing his work and magic. I think you guys have just come up with a great project. And I'm sure, like I said, it will fly off the shelves. And I think a similar thing to all the other projects that we've spoken about in general now, I think it'll just unite people to have something in common, you know, because like I said, we don't all come into these trades via the same route. We don't all have the same career backgrounds, but I think having watches like this and having something just unique really does bring, for want of a better expression, a sense of esprit de corps, you know, within units. And I think that's fantastic. Before we move on, Larry, to obviously the closing note element of the episode, because obviously I've taken up a lot of your time tonight. Is there anything you feel like you've missed, be it about your own personal collecting journey, anything about psychological operations that you think the audience might be interested in, or Psywar Risk Check as a page, or your Psywar projects for watchers?
So I guess for the professionals, especially for the you know, like the new guys that are just joining the regiment or are in the regiment. Yes, watches are great, but obviously the big thing is always just going out and communicating and finding an interest and just practicing, you know, your way of expressing it through writing, because through my page and writing reviews, I've seen kind of like my quality of how I communicate to different audiences improve. And then for everyone across the allied component, like enterprise. So, you know, British, Australian, if you ever see a PSYOP planner out in a training exercise, don't be afraid to talk to us, because when it comes down to work is like at the end of the day, right? Like we'll have our own messages or we'll design our own kind of operations. But at the same time too, you know, we look to synchronize effects to tell the story to whoever we're intending to tell the story. I've worked with BritishSoft on deployments, and I've worked with British, New Zealand. I've worked with Australian. I'm going through my head of like my badge trades. Korean. I've worked with all. With all sorts of partners and allies, and we all. And it's interesting that sure, we might not be whatever affected as they're trying to deliver, or they're not psychological operations, but like, I guess in professional sense, coordinating and synchronizing effects is always kind of like a big component that people kind of like leave in the back burner. They just want to say, hey, I just want this delivered so I can make my side happy. But it's like, hey, what if we do this? And at the same time they do this, and this is the overall picture. And I've seen a lot of success with that. I guess that's just coming from my artillery targeting backgrounds. Like we're not the star of the show, but we can make recommendations and synchronize effects to kind of generate what the final boss wants or the supporting commander. I appreciate your time, man. Thank you so much. This has been super fun.
I've really enjoyed it. It's been really good, and I'm sure at some point we'll probably get you back on the podcast, maybe for an update after the GMT Watch project has been delivered, and when there's maybe a bigger update in terms of the Presidius project, we can pull you back on. I will take more of your time to do that, and we can obviously have another conversation about all of that kind of stuff. Moving on to the closing notes, obviously, it's the traditional element of the show where we basically tell the audience to go away and do some homework. As you're my guest, what closing note do you have for the audience today?
So my book recommendation is Ghost Fleet by August Cole and P.W. Singer. So it's their fiction narrative telling what the next world war will look like using trends, geopolitical and military development evidence that exists today. So both authors work extensively with the military and the diplomatic side of that diplomacy and policy. Where actually a fun fact is I received professional development training from them on writing.
That's cool.
They're fantastic guys. They can tell an awesome story. So the fun part is after my first deployment in PSYOP, I reread the book. And as the chapters went forward, I just remember saying, oh, that would happen. Or, yeah, that's not completely off par of how it would turn out. And it also covers warfare across all domains. So it's a good read for anyone, whether it be the Air Force, Navy, Cywar, Special Operations. Yeah. But for guys in the PSYOP regiment, you know, when you read this book, I would recommend that you pay attention to how the narrative is shifted between the military problem set and what guys back home in the civilian, you know, at home, the home front were going through. And then for Cywar professionals, if you're scrolling Instagram, not only check out both our pages, but look at watch pages and just pay attention to how Omega, Rolex, Christopher Ward, Presidius, how they message to influence potential audiences into spending big money on a technology that your phone and a $15 Pokemon watch can do for much less and is likely less accurate.
Yeah, definitely. I've actually read Ghost Fleet. I think it's a fantastic book. And if you didn't know this, on the British side, it's actually in the junior officers reading list suggestions before you go to your various commissioning academies, schools, you know, institutions. And then from my background as an intelligence operator, it was actually also on the reading list for intelligence NCOs of a certain kind of specialism, just because of, like I said, how well it was written and the research that went into it. I really enjoyed it. And I actually have it as an Audible book as well. And sometimes just throw it on because, like I said, it's a great story and it's very interesting. And like you said, it's a bit scary sometimes where you sit there kind of go, oh, that's actually not out of the realms of, you know, impossibility, which is always, you know, like I said, especially when I'm driving, I'm like, oh, you know, but it's a very good story. So yeah, guys, go check it out. My closing note is I've got two. So one is another book and the other is a little bit more of Turn off brain and watch a bit of gratuitous violence set in the Wild West. So we'll start with that one. It's called The English, and it's all about effectively the Wild West in America. And it centers around effectively a English lady, literally a lady. She's got her ladyship, and she travels out to America in order to effectively find a family member who went out to America before her, effectively to kind of reconcile out of, you know, certain, you know, situations and all that kind of stuff. But along the way, she befriends a Native American Indian from the Pawnee tribe, who basically teaches her how to survive, right? It's all fictitious, but it's shot very well. And it's, like I said, it is very violent. So if you're not into that kind of stuff, which I'm sure a lot of the people in the audience like a little bit of gratuitous violence, you know, being ex-military, serving military and law enforcement and all that kind of stuff. So just disengage brain, watch something different, and it's on Amazon Prime. So there's that one. However, when you re-engage your brain, I want you to go and try and find a copy of the book. And if you can't find a copy of the book, please reach out to me, because I'm sure I can find one for you. And the book is called The History of the PWE. So History of the PWE, as we said earlier in the podcast, the political warfare executive was very important. It had various ties, obviously, with the propaganda, effectively, and the psychological operations within World War II, led by the British. It had ties to the Special Operations Executive that we know conducted operations behind enemy lines in the European and Italian theatre, and obviously tied in with the OSS as well. So that book is by a gentleman called David Garnett. Okay, I will put it in the show notes. However, just so you're aware, to make it easier for you, if you do want to buy it, it's not on Kindle. You cannot get it as a digital. You have to go on eBay or go onto like Amazon used, because it went out of print in like 2008 or something like that. It is a heavy read. It's a very heavy reference kind of book. So if you do get it, and it's obviously something that you want to read, my only advice is take it a chapter at a time, okay? Because it's quite detailed. It's written as an old history textbook, would have been back in like the 1970s, because that's just basically it is from a guy who served, you know, and then mm-hmm. went into the archives, and it's just the material that he was, you know, given access to is all written in a very old style, and I found it was quite a heavy read. However, there's some absolute gold in there. Like I said, if you're a professional science practitioner, where you can look at it, and from my point of view, I look at it and kind of go, wow, we're still learning some of the lessons from 70, 80 years ago, and we have just reinvented the wheel, and we're trying to put it into a digital age, you know. So maybe go and have a look at it from a professional point and think, how can we apply the lessons learned from World War II without committing the same mistakes? It's my opinion. Okay, so go check that out. Larry, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I've really enjoyed it. Clearly, I want you to come back on again, and we will organize that at some point. But I'm glad you had a great Christmas. A happy new year to you and your family again. And we'll catch you again soon in another episode, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Thanks, Dan. Happy holidays. Oh, Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. And thank you for inviting me and being awesome on this podcast. I had an absolute blast, and looking forward to the next one.
Happy days. All right, guys. All until right. Then, we'll catch you later. Bye.